Luke chapter 23. No doubt, Pontius Pilate felt a radical relief, a burden lifted from his shoulders, when he discovered that Jesus was considered a Galilean. And when Pontius heard this, that he was a Galilean, he said, "Great, that places him in Herod's jurisdiction. I don't have to make a judgment. I don't have to make a decision. We will send him over to Herod, who just so happened to be in Jerusalem for this Passover session." Pontius Pilate made the same error here that many people make in thinking they don't have to make a decision, a judgment concerning Jesus Christ. A couple of hours ago, I was talking to a fellow who was just absolutely convinced that he didn't have to decide about Jesus Christ being unique, being God. That he could simply be open to Jesus Christ, even as he's open to Buddha, even as he's open to Confucius, even as he's open to Socrates or whoever. And he didn't want to be pressed into making a decision concerning, "But who do you say that he is?" For he claimed to be God. He claimed to be exclusively the only way to heaven. And he called all others, which would include Buddha, which would include Confucius and Socrates, he called them all thieves and liars, anyone who would imply that there's another route to make it into eternal life. And so I pushed this fellow and I said, "Here's the problem. You've got to make a decision. Either Jesus is who he claimed to be, or he's a liar. Making claims of deity that are not true, making claims of exclusivity which don't hold water, you can't have it both ways. He's either the Lord or he's a liar. There is a third option. He's a loony, crazy." But this fellow ended our conversation by saying, "Hey, don't push me. I believe in Jesus and I believe in all of the masters." People don't want to make a decision, a judgment. But listen carefully. Even as Pontius Pilate here thought, "Hey, great. I don't have to decide about this man. I can send him over to Herod." Jesus is now coming back to face Pontius Pilate once again. And if you perhaps are in the room tonight, and perhaps you think, "I don't really have to make a decision dogmatically about who Jesus is." Hey, you're mistaken. Because not to decide is a decision. If you don't decide, you are deciding. Now tell this to people that you're witnessing to that say, "Well, I just don't know what to think. I don't have to decide." You tell them, if you are saying, "I'm not going to decide," you have now made your decision. What do you mean? Suppose I went to Bob Baugh and I said, "Bob, here are two tickets. All expenses paid, a trip to Tahiti. Here's your airline tickets. Here is your hotel vouchers. Here is your rental car agreement. Take off tomorrow at 10 o'clock. The plane is leaving. You'll fly down to Long Beach. You'll pick up on a cruise liner that is going from Long Beach to Tahiti, and it's all expenses paid. Here it is. Now, what if Bob says, "Wow, that's great. Thanks, John. What a guy. You're one terrific guy. That's really, that's thoughtful of you. All expenses paid cruise to Tahiti." But I don't know, man. Cosby's on tomorrow night, and you know, I haven't mowed my lawn this week yet, and I don't know, really. I just don't know what to do. And so he spends the evening thinking about whether he should take up this offer to Tahiti, and he's not deciding, and then tomorrow the day comes, the hour passes, the flight leaves Medford International Airport. A few hours later, the ship pulls out from the docks of Long Beach on the way to Tahiti, and Bob's still saying, "Well, I just don't know what to do." Hey, he's done it. By not deciding, he has missed the boat. By not deciding, he's made his decision. And a person who says, "I'm just not deciding," I want you to know, and you tell them, "Hey, the ship is leaving. And your not deciding is a decision." Bob could say, "I never decided not to go." The fact remains is, in not deciding, he made his decision. The ship went without him. And we need to address this issue with our family and friends and people that we converse with who want to say, "Well, don't push me." We need to say, "Hey, in your not deciding, you are making a decision." Pontius Pilate found that out. He thought, "Great. I don't want to deal with this man, Jesus. I don't find any fault in him, but I don't want to make a decision. I'll send him off to Herod." And we left off in our study last week seeing Jesus being sent off to Herod, and Herod wanted him to do a miracle. But Jesus answered him not a word and performed for him not a trick. Herod now then, in frustration, throwing up his hands, sends Jesus back to Pilate. And don't you know, when Pilate looks out the window and sees the entourage coming, Jesus returning, his heart must be sinking. "Oh no, I thought I didn't have to make a call, a decision, a judgment, and here he comes again." And the story picks up. And Pilate, verse 13 of chapter 23, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people, said, "You have brought this man unto me as one that perverteth people. But behold, I have examined him before you. I have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod. For I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. I will therefore chastise him," or scourge him, "and then release him." Whoa. Talk about a lack of justice. A total void of integrity. Pontius Pilate says, "Hey, he's done nothing wrong, but I'm going to scourge him anyway." Well, if he's done nothing wrong, pray tell, what right did he have to order a scourging, a lashing, which would often lead to death? Extremely painful, very brutal. But justice often works this way. People trying to compromise or find a solution that somehow will get them off the hook. Today the decision came down there in Florida, West Palm Beach, to charge William Kennedy Smith with second-degree sexual battery. And when they asked, of course, this police chief who made that announcement, "Well, what exactly is second-degree sexual battery?" The police chief said, "Well, we are totally convinced, the evidence is overwhelming, that a rape took place." Well, then why not simply file for charges of rape? Well, because second degree sexual battery, he responded, means that a rape took place, but there was no injury done to the victim. Now, when I heard that, I thought, wait a minute. How can a rape take place and no injury done to the victim? I don't understand that. I can't figure out what that means. Somebody's been raped and yet it's second degree sexual battery because there was no injury done, supposedly. Somehow there's compromises going on behind the scenes, deals being cut. There's no question about that, at least in my thinking. And here Pontius Pilate is doing the same kind of maneuvering, shenaniganing, saying, well, let's scourge him, and then I'm going to release him, hoping somehow to appease everybody, but in so doing, he will really satisfy nobody. And so, verse 17 goes on to say that after he made that announcement, he will chasten him, then release him, because you see, of necessity, Pontius must release one criminal at this feast. It was traditional. And they cried out, hearing this, saying, away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas, who for a certain sedition made in the city, and for murder was cast into prison. Pontius said, it's my prerogative to release a prisoner during this celebration. They said, release Barabbas. Interesting, because Barabbas means Bar-Abbas, son of the father. And the church father Origen tells us that his first name was Yeshua, or Jesus. So here is Jesus, Yeshua, Barabbas, Jesus, son of the Father, who was a criminal indicted for insurrection. What happened was, this Jesus, Barabbas, Jesus, son of the Father, claimed to be a Messiah. And he would bring in the kingdom, overthrowing the Romans by insurrection, revolution. He was found guilty of murder because in this insurrection, blood was shed, lives were lost, and he was arrested, this Jesus Bar-Abbas. What an irony. You have Jesus Bar-Abbas on one side and Jesus, the true Son of the Father, whose ministry was not based upon insurrection but on resurrection. Not insurrection violently, but resurrection internally. That is, he would rise from the dead and he would live his life in his followers, bringing in the kingdom, which is righteousness, peace, and joy. But there are those still to this day who want to bring in the kingdom violently or politically or legislatively. And it just ain't gonna be. The Lord's kingdom is not of this world. Jesus Barabbas thought he could bring in the kingdom with an insurrection, with a revolution. But Jesus, the true Son of the Father, brings in the kingdom by resurrection and regeneration. People being born again, changed internally. What a contrast here. And the people, hey, release us Barabbas. We want activity. We don't want spirituality. We want insurrection. Forget this resurrection. We want to do something, not be something. We want Barabbas released to us. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spoke again to this crowd, but they cried all the more, crucify him, crucify him. And he said unto them the third time, why? What evil has he done? I have found no cause of him of death in him. I will therefore chasten him and let him go. And they were instant with loud voices, demanding that he be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed. And Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. And he released unto them him that for sedition or insurrection and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired, but he delivered Jesus to their will. Pontius Pilate, hearing the voices of those crying in verse 23, crucify him, gave in to the voices of them. Pontius heard two voices that day very clearly. The voice of conscience internally, and the voice of the crowd externally. How often we find ourselves hearing the voices of the crowd trying to get us to go in a certain direction, to make a compromise, to go into some carnal activity. Hey, come on, everybody's doing it, the crowd tells us. How tragic it is when you, when me, when any of us give in to the loud voices of the crowd instead of submitting to that still small internal voice of conscience, of the Spirit within us. But there's always a match going on between the voices of the crowd. Go here, man. Do this, man. It's acceptable. This is 1990. Don't be so stuffy. The voices of the crowd versus the internal voice of truth within. Pilate gave in. The crowd prevailed. The voices were loud, and he succumbed to the pressure. Historians then tell us that Pontius Pilate, shortly after this event, went off into isolation to the island of Sicily. He was approached years later by a disciple of Jesus Christ, according to tradition, according to history, and was asked, Pontius, you remember Jesus of Nazareth, whom you sentenced to death? And a blank look came across the face of Pontius Pilate when he said, Jesus of Nazareth? I don't remember a thing about him. And this follower of Jesus was taken back, was shocked, was amazed that Pontius Pilate truly did not remember a single thing that took place on that eventful day. You see, the reason he was sent to Sicily is because he lost it mentally. He lost it emotionally. And shortly after that dialogue, this particular historical record goes, whether it be true or not, we can't speak with certainty, but it's very conceivable that it is so, that shortly after this discussion, this conversation with that follower of Jesus, Pontius, truly not remembering anything but was haunted internally, and went out and, like Judas Iscariot, he hung himself there on the cliffs of Sicily, committed suicide. Gang, I'll tell you how to get hung up. Listen to the crowd. Go with what society is saying, with what Madison Avenue is advertising. Just go down that path. Don't listen to the conscience, to the spirit within. Listen to the crowd without, and you'll end up getting hung up and dying. A tragic character, Pontius Pilate. Well, he said, okay, take him away. And they did. They led him away. And verse 26 tells us that as they led him away, they laid hold upon one Simon, a Cyrenian. Cyrene being in Tripoli, Libya today, probably a black man. They're 800 miles away, saving probably all of his adult days to make that journey to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. And now he's there. He finally makes it to the city, Simon of Cyrene, watching the events, seeing Jesus, already having been scourged now, bleeding profusely, beaten beyond recognition, now making his way down the Via Dolorosa, headed outside of the city, carrying a cross on his back. And Jesus collapses under the weight of that cross, and the Roman guards that were escorting him out of the city into the area called Calvary looked at Jesus lying on the pavement, no doubt in a pool of his own blood, and did what they had the right to do, taking the spear of the Roman soldier and placing the flat side of that spear upon another's shoulder. That meant you had to carry the burden of that soldier for at least 1 mile. Remember how Jesus taught earlier, go two, when somebody asks you to carry his burden for one? Simon must have been bummed when he felt the cold metal of that head spear placed upon his shoulder. He must have been bummed. Oh no. Why me? What's going on here? But the law decreed that he had no choice, and so he picks up that cross and carries that cross down the road up to that hill called Calvary outside the holy city. Interesting. Mark tells us in his gospel that Simon was the father of Rufus and Alexander. Big deal, you say. Well, in Romans 16, right around verse 13, Paul says, greet Rufus and Alexander for me. Which means that Rufus and Alexander were well-known Christians. Mentioned in Mark, greeted in Romans, the implication would be that Simon got converted, probably this day, when he carried the cross. And I point that out to you not simply as a historical footnote, but there's a tremendous personal application. Those who carry the cross of Christ will fall in love with Jesus Christ. It's ironic. It's a mystery. Oh no, we say, I don't want to go through that. I don't want to do that. I don't want to carry that. It's too heavy. It's too burdensome. Why me? But you see, Jesus gave a most incredible truth when he said, the person who carries his cross daily, that is, dies to self, will find real life. The more you deny yourself and your flesh, the more you focus on the kingdom, the more that you carry the cross, you will have life, man. The more you live for yourself, to pamper yourself, to please yourself, to make life easy for yourself, you will become in direct proportion to what you live for yourself, you will experience misery and hollowness inside. Jesus said the key to living is to die. To not live for yourself. If any man come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And he who loses his life so doing will find it. But he who lives for his life will lose it. Gang, in that is a profound truth. And you can practice it this week. The more you die to self, the more happy you'll be. The more you focus on yourself and live for yourself, the more miserable you'll feel. So here's Simon. Initially, oh, bummer. Why me? But as he makes that walk down that road, up the hill, suddenly something begins to happen inside of him. And he becomes a believer. a lover of Jesus Christ, who trained evidently his two sons, Rufus and Alexander, in the faith. Note one more thing here. Jesus could not carry the cross. Why? Because you see, when a person was being crucified, to declare their guilt to the entire city, the victim would have to carry the cross, and in so doing would be advertising, I am guilty. Here's the question. Was Jesus guilty? No. Jesus was not guilty of any sin. Therefore, this event had to take place because he was not guilty. And so we see Simon here now, carrying the cross, bearing it after Jesus, verse 27. And there followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented. Oh, these women of sympathy saw this man of sorrows. How beautiful are these women. Women of sympathy seeing the man of sorrows, and they lamented. Gals, did you know that in the Gospels there is never one woman who was an enemy of Jesus Christ? Sometimes gals say, hey, how come the apostles were all men? They were. So was Judas. How come so much of the New Testament revolves around men? Pontius Pilate and Herod and Annas and Caiaphas and the rulers of the synagogue and the plotters and the killers. Hey, as far as the Gospels go, the women are in good standing. In every instance, they are seen as sympathetic to Jesus Christ and friends of Jesus Christ. Special. For you college students that are perhaps taking women's studies, I would encourage you to do a term paper on the impact of the gospel upon women's liberation. You see, as you look down history, every place the gospel has been preached, the standing of women has been elevated and their dignity has been returned. Every place the gospel has not gone, women are treated like animals. Take a trip to Kuwait this summer. Look around Saudi Arabia. Go to the jungle cultures of Micronesia. Check it out and you'll find that wherever the gospel has not been received, women have real, brutal lots in life. But wherever the gospel has gone, without exception, to the proportion that that gospel has been embraced, women have been elevated. There's a good term paper for you. Blow your prof away. Be good. So these women here bewailed and lamented. Jesus then turned to these gals and said, daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming in which they shall say, blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bear, and the paps that never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? Hey, don't feel sorry for me, Jesus is saying. My agony is about to end, even this day. But you in Jerusalem are going to go through incredibly difficult times. If they've done this in the time of spring to a green tree, wait till the Romans show their real vehemence against this city when it's dry. And they did. We talked about how during that 143-day siege, when the Romans began to surround Jerusalem and attack Jerusalem, how 600,000 were killed in that 143 days. And Josephus tells us there was cannibalism going on in the city. They were starving therein. And men actually would eat their infant children. And women would be lamenting. Cannibalism, death, destruction. Even as Jesus said would happen. And here he's reminding them, don't weep for me. Sometimes when bad things happen to us as believers, friends, neighbors, relatives will come and say, oh, I feel so sorry for you. And I often find myself thinking this, don't weep for me. I'm out of here soon. Life is short. Weep for yourself if you're not saved. Don't weep for me because this is the worst it's ever going to be for me. It's all uphill, man. We're going to heaven. Everything is going to be better than it is now. But if you're not a believer, you should be weeping. Because for you, this is the best it's ever going to be. It's all downhill from here. Truly. And Jesus here is saying, don't weep for me. My agony is about to end. There were also two other malefactors led with him to be put to death. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, or in the Greek cranium, from which we get our word cranium, the place of the skull, there they crucified him. And the malefactors, the thieves, one on the right hand and the other on the left. This was deliberately designed to bring humiliation to Jesus. A thief on the left, a thief on the right, but it was deliberately designed by God as an illustration. Oh, you know the illustration. Two men equally close to Jesus, having the same perspective on Jesus, and yet making an entirely different decision about Jesus. One would be ushered into the kingdom. The other would be lost into eternal damnation. I cannot figure out why some people, hearing the same gospel, the same evidence, why some people respond and others don't. It's a real mystery to me. I think it is also very appropriate that our Lord was crucified between two thieves, as I spoke to you before. Because Jesus came to steal our hearts. He came to steal your heart. Opening up his arms to you, expressing powerfully that he's in love with you. He loves you more than your mother loves you. He loves you more than your husband loves you or your wife loves you. He loves you more than the closest person to you loves you. He's in love with you. And he opens up his arms. And the blood and fluid of his heart comes gushing out of his side. And he seeks to tell you unmistakably, irrefutably, I love you. I really do love you. You. Not just I love the world generally, but I love you. Monica, Dan, John, I love you. And so he sought to steal away their hearts, and so I think it's appropriate that he was crucified between two thieves. Then Jesus said, verse 34, as he's there pinned to that cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Hey, did you know if a person doesn't know what he's doing is wrong, that doesn't alleviate the responsibility to pay a price? Jesus said, Father, these who are cursing and spitting and barking, and mocking and jeering, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. But notice forgiveness and intercession and provision is still required, even for a person who is sinning ignorantly or unaware that what they're doing, saying, thinking is a sin. How many of you thought when you first got saved, hey man, oh, this is great, I'm born again, and as soon as I give up cocaine, there's no other problem in my life. I'll be holy. How many of you have found that the closer you get to the Lord, the more you walk with the Lord, the more you realize, wow, there's a whole lot of stuff that I never even knew was not right. It just keeps surfacing and keeps coming, and wow, I didn't even know that stuff. I wasn't even aware of that stuff going on in my thoughts or in my heart. Doesn't matter. Even if you don't know it's sin, you still need to be forgiven. Father, a price needs to be paid. Father, forgive them, even as I am shedding my blood on behalf of them. But they, at the foot of the cross, were gambling for his clothes, casting lots. And the people, verse 35, stood beholding, and the rulers also with them derided him, saying, he saved others. Hey, interesting. At last, truth comes out. He saved others. Those who were saying he was Beelzebub, demonized, illegitimately birthed, a heretic, no good in him. Those that were saying, get him out of here, crucify him. In this moment, they actually let out a truth. Perhaps, probably very unintentionally, he saved others. Are you being criticized? Are you being found with fault unfairly? Is there somebody or perhaps some group coming down on you? Guess what? Hang in there. I say that respectfully. Jesus on the cross hung in there. And he, in a sense, outlived his critics, you see. And so will you. There might be those who right now deride you and find fault with you and question your sincerity or your integrity or question your spirituality or your sanity. They did all of that with Jesus. But guess what? He hung in there. Prayed for him. Father, forgive them. And somehow the truth slipped out. The truth slipped out. These guys had to admit what they were previously not willing to say. He saved others. The blind were touched. The lepers were cleansed. The dead were raised. Lives were impacted. He did indeed save others. And then they say, let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar. And they said also, if thou be the king of the Jews, save thyself. The rulers and the soldiers were both saying, if you really are the king, a king is made known in his ability to assert himself. But Jesus is more than a king. He's a shepherd who is dying on behalf of his sheep. Where you work, in your home, at your school, the world will say, hey, stand up for your rights. Prove that you're a man of authority by standing up for your position. Books are written, winning through intimidation, watching out for number one. Our whole society follows the Donald Trump mentality. Intimidate. Bully. Maneuver. Leverage. Whatever. And that's what these rulers and soldiers were saying. Hey, if you're really the Christ, if you're really the king, prove it. Show us what you can do. Make it happen. They didn't understand that in the kingdom, the way of authority is not manipulation or intimidation. The way to authority is sacrifice. He's a shepherd, dying for others, not intimidating others. A good lesson for every single husband who's here tonight. Woman, submit. Ephesians 5 says so. If you ever have to say to your wife, I'm the boss here, Ephesians 5 says so emphatically, so submit to me right away, A, you're missing the whole point. You're to love your wife as Christ loved the church. And how does he love? He died. He gave himself. And it was painful. The minute we as husbands have to say, I'm in charge here, you submit to me, lady, then you've missed it totally. For you that are employers, the minute you say, hey, I'm in charge here, listen to me, in that kind of tone and mentality, hey, you've just proven you don't have authority. If you have to put a tag on your chest saying who you are, so submit to me, you're not doing what Jesus did. You see, the world's kings save themselves and watch out for themselves. But the King of Kings, Jesus Christ, is a shepherd who gave his life, man. If he saved himself, he couldn't have saved others. And so he heard their taunting, if thou be a king, verse 37, save thyself. And a superscription also was written over him in the letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. Greek, the language of the intellect. Latin, the language of government. And Hebrew, the language of religion. Philosophically, politically, religiously. He is the King of the Jews. And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, if thou be the Christ, save thyself and us. The other answering said, dost not thou fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing amiss. And he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. The one thief, get me down. The other thief, Lord, take me up. Honestly, what's your prayer life like? Lord, get me down. Get me out of this mess. Or is it, Lord, take me up into a higher understanding, a higher perspective of you with eternity's values before me. Remember me, Lord. Interesting how I love this thief who just in humility and seeing the big picture said, Lord, remember me. Not, Lord, get me out of here. Take me down. Just remember me, Lord, when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said, today you're going to be with me in paradise. And it was about the sixth hour, verse 44 tells us, and there was a darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. Jesus crucified at 9 a.m., the third hour, and then at noon, suddenly it became dark. Dark until 3 o'clock when he would give up the ghost. You see, the people desired to live in darkness. They said to the light of the world, we will not have this man rule over us. And consequently, they will now be in darkness, literally. What an eerie darkness it must have been. Wasn't an eclipse, by the way. I've heard that rap. That's baloney. It's the Passover, full moon. There's no eclipse going on here. It's a supernatural darkness that must have been terrifying and haunting, but it must have so pierced the souls of those that really knew what was going on. Hey, we rejected this light of the world and now we are in total darkness. And to the extent that you and me reject the light of the Word, the light of Jesus, our lives will be in that proportion filled with a terrifying darkness. Walk in the light, John tells us. But they didn't. They turned on the light. They turned out the light. And it became dark. And the veil in the temple was rent. This veil, from top to bottom, rent. And now suddenly, the Holy of Holies was exposed for the first time in centuries. The Holy of Holies was exposed, and in essence, God is declaring to you today and to me, open house. Come in. No more ceremonial sacrifices, no more religious rituals. The work is done. Come on into my presence anytime you want, you who believe in Jesus. The price has been paid fully. The veil is rent from top to bottom, you see. The Holy of Holies, the Shekinah glory, the presence of God, now available freely. Don't sew up the veil. Don't ever get out your sewing kit and start saying, well, you really can't come into the presence of God until you sing 6 worship songs. That's not true. Or I can't come into the presence of God until first I have devotions for 3 days. Or I can't come into the presence of God until I give up chewing gum or whatever it might be that people place upon themselves. Funny things, odd things, bizarre things, religious things, traditional things, ceremonial things. The veil was rent and God is saying it's open, it's done, it's finished. The work is paid. Don't sew it back up again. Don't sew it back up again. But legalism does that. Churches are notorious for that. Little formulas and principles that stitch by stitch sew up the veil. Little here, little there. Got to do this, got to be that, got to have short hair. And they just start sewing up the veil. I'm an American. But the veil rent and the way in, free for all who would believe in Jesus Christ, understanding what He did on the cross. Celebrate. Anytime. Move into His presence freely, joyfully. And then when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, 46, He said, Father, into Thy hands I commend My spirit. And having thus said, He gave up the ghost. It's finished. It's done. Think with me. Genesis tells us that the Father, after 6 days of creation, rested on the seventh. It was the Sabbath. He looked at all that He made over 6 days and He said, it is very good. And He rested. Jesus Christ is now on the cross for 6 hours. And now He's resting. It is finished. 6 days in creation, 6 hours on Calvary, and he rests. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. By the way, this is a quotation from Psalms. And this was the prayer of Jewish children when they went to bed every night. Like our, now I lay me down to sleep. They would quote this verse, Psalm 31, verse 5. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. In so doing, Jesus is saying it's done. The price is paid. The work is complete. I'm resting. Into your hands I'm committing my spirit. Now when the centurion, verse 47, saw what was done, this centurion overseeing the actual physical crucifixion, when this centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, certainly, this was a righteous man. This guy is right on. Another gospel tells us he would go on to say, this truly was the Son of God. What convinced this centurion? Would you notice this with me? It was in the way Jesus handled suffering and death and pain and rejection. This rugged centurion, centurions were noted for their bravery, for their masculinity, for their military prowess and their physical ability. This rugged centurion was not impressed with the Jews, no doubt, until he saw the way this one, the king of the Jews, faced suffering and pain and death. And that's when he was converted. Pray tell, why do we as believers insist on never going through suffering when it is actually the method that the Lord uses to bring about the conversion of many a centurion? In Exodus chapter 14, God had his people camp there between Pi-hahiroth and Migdol with their back to the Red Sea. You know the story. Why? He put them in a tough spot, in a difficult place. For what purpose? Read the chapter. It tells you that I might be glorified amongst the Egyptians, that they will see my people boxed in, having a real problem. And then what I do to get them through eventually. That the Egyptians might know. Now, who are the Egyptians? You know that the Egyptians are a type of the world, biblically. Why do we always say, I don't want to be boxed in. I don't want to go through hard times. I don't want to feel physical pain. When in reality, that is what convinces the Egyptians, what convinces the centurions. I have watched people die physically, very long, excruciating deaths. One of my mentors, a dear brother, Dave Kraft, at the age of 31 with a young family, I watched him die a long, difficult, prolonged, painful death. And although his teaching and preaching was powerful and fruitful for many years as a young man, nothing impacted that church or the community like the way he handled pain and death. And many, many were saved that never would have been touched had he been healed in the way that many of us wanted and prayed for him to be. A number of years ago, there was a political slogan, "Let Reagan be Reagan." You might recall that if you're politically oriented. Let Reagan be Reagan. Let him be who he is. That's what he is the best. I say to you tonight, Christians, let God be God. Let him do what he wants to do. Yes, we should pray. Yes, we should make our requests and our petitions and express our hearts. Yes, we should persevere, but let God be God. Let him do what he wants to do in your life, even if it seems painful to you. Hard to understand. Jesus our model. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. On the other side of that cross was great joy. The centurion, a hard man's man, was finally blown away when he watched the way that Jesus suffered and died, and yet was at such peace. Father, forgive them. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And he was one, converted. And all the people, verse 48, that came together to that sight, beholding these things, smote their breasts. They knew they did wrong. They knew it was a travesty of justice. And all his acquaintance and the women that followed him from Galilee stood afar off, beholding these things. And there, verse 50, was a man named Joseph, a counselor, part of the Sanhedrin, a good man, a just man. The same had not consented to the counsel and deed of them. That is the judgment of crucifying Christ. He was of Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who also waited for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. And he took it down and wrapped it in linen. Interesting. Wrapped in linen. The very garments that the high priest would wear on Yom Kippur. Linen garments. Oh, that's another story. Get the tape from Easter Sunday. But wrapped it up in linen. And he laid it in a sepulcher that was hewn in stone, wherein never man before was laid. And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. That is, the day of Passover was now at hand. Joseph of Arimathea, a rich man, a good man, an honorable man, opened up a tomb that was previously unused, probably hewed out for him personally. He didn't care what it cost him, monetarily or politically. He was impressed with Jesus when he was watching him dying on that tree. Again, history tells us, and we can't be dogmatic about this, but there's good deals of evidence that Joseph of Arimathea, this man who took the Lord's body and placed it in the tomb, risking everything, his business, his position, even his ability to celebrate the Passover ceremonially, touching a dead body. History tells us that in the year 61, that Philip, the apostle, sent Joseph of Arimathea to England. And there in Glastonbury is a church that, according to their records, indeed does date back to the days of Joseph of Arimathea. There is good evidence to believe this is so. Now, this tradition goes on to say that when Joseph, now living for the Lord totally, after, of course, the resurrection, he took with him to England the chalice that was used by the Lord at the Last Supper, which became known as the Holy Grail. For you that are aware of history and the Knights of the Round Table and their search in England, their obsession with the Holy Grail. And it could very well be so. We don't know. But Joseph probably did go to England and evangelize and start ministry there. And it's conceivable that he would have that treasure that perhaps was entrusted to him because of the tomb that he had given so generously at such great risk to him personally. We'll have to watch the video in heaven to find out if that really did take place or not. But be that as it may, he was a good man. And the women also, verse 55, which came with him from Galilee, followed after and beheld the sepulcher and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment. And we'll stop there this evening and we'll look at the glorious burst of joy that happens on Resurrection Sunday in our study next time together. Shall we stand? If any man come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. The one who is madly in love with you is the one who gives that commandment to you. Not to make your life miserable. Oh, this is the cross that I'm bearing. Life is hard. Being a Christian is tough. You think being a Christian is tough? Try not being a Christian. Not being able to pray with confidence. Not knowing where you're going to spend eternity. Not knowing what principles upon which to build your family. Not knowing that your sins are forgiven. That's tough. Being a Christian is so liberating and so freeing. And for you that have been saved for 5 years or more, you are in danger of beginning to think, oh, this is tough. Suffering for the Lord. You've forgotten what it's like in the world without the Lord. See, Satan has this incredible ability to remind you of the good times, so-called, in the world. The kicks. But he never brings to your memory the kickbacks. Oh yeah, me and the boys at the fraternity. Yeah, we broke out the kegs and man, that was great. Ha ha. He never says, remember barfing in the bathroom the whole day followed? How sick you felt. Remember you didn't know what you did to who and why and how and where and the problems and sadnesses and diseases and sickness that came? Satan never says, remember that? He just says, oh, remember the keggers? Oh, yeah. That's so dumb. It wasn't good in the world. The Egyptians, or pardon me, the people of Israel in the wilderness, what did they say? Oh, Moses, you brought us out here to die. Man, the melons and onions and leeks we used to have in Egypt, those were the good old days. You know what? They never had melons and onions and leeks, whatever a leek is. They never had them. That was not what was happening. They were being beaten, making pyramids for Pharaoh in the hot burning sun, mud without bricks. Their babies were being killed. It was torture, but all they could think about was, oh, the good old days, melons and onions and leeks. That's what happened. That's human nature. To reminisce unrealistically, it was rotten back then, gang. So when Jesus says, take up the cross, he's not saying, yeah, well, you've had your fun times and now it's time to be in agony and misery. Take up your cross. No. He's saying, if you'll do this, you'll find real joy. If you die to self. If you resist those things which are so carnal and worldly and trite and empty, turn away from them. Die to those things. Take up your cross. Live for the kingdom. Give your life for your wife, for your children, for others, for ministry, for eternity. And Jesus said, in so doing, you'll find life. Try it this week. Just this week, take up your cross, die to self. And you'll find a quality of life that is wonderful. Jesus Christ, He gave His life for us and left an example to us that we might find ourselves, no matter how painful life might seem, how difficult it might be, that with perfect peace we can say, Father, forgive, and Father, into Your hands I commend. And people will marvel. And you will have life abundantly and eternally. Help us now, Lord, to understand what You did, to rejoice in the work that was done, and to follow in Your footsteps, in Jesus' name.